Welcome to the Cello Sherpa Podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Welcome to our 50th episode. Today's guest is Atlanta-based cellist, teacher, and clinician Mary Beth Bryant. She is on faculty at Berry College, certified as a Suzuki instructor, and has been running a private studio for nearly 20 years that always has a waiting list. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So you're a very sought-after private cello teacher. Can you talk a little bit about your teaching philosophy?
Sure. So when I first meet a student, I really want them to feel safe and comfortable around me because I find them to be really interesting little people. And so my main goal is developing a rapport and making them feel comfortable to be themselves around me, because I feel like when a kid feels safe, they can learn more effectively. One of my students was telling me about how he does weightlifting regularly, and that's something I'm really intrigued by because I find it to be so boring. It's just, you know, lifting a weight over and over again. How fun is that? In my mind, it's just not at all, but I know it's good for you. And so I'm captivated by people who choose to do this regularly. And so in his case, I was really intrigued because his cello practice was a struggle. So he had the time, he just didn't choose to use it wisely. So I was telling him, you know, I did 2-pound weights in this body pump class, and he's like, you know, I do 50-pound weights. And he kind of laughed at me, and we've had a little weightlifting bond there. But my philosophy, I'm always curious. I'm always trying to learn something new about my student to kind of hook into them and see what drives them. And with that one particular student, he was telling me that seeing his gains, getting stronger, competing with his friends, and being around other kids was really motivating for him. And so I was thinking, how can I do this with cello? So I've taken some courses at Emory called Influence and Persuasion and Business. And I observed my friend's kids at karate because I was asking her, you know, why do her kids always do these assignments, these chores that they have on their little list of paper that they have to turn into karate each week? And she said, well, they get a stripe on their belt every week. And I said, that's it? And she said, yeah, that's all they have to do is just get a stripe on their belt. So I decided to develop this concept called Cello Kwando, where the students basically fill out their assignments. They check that they did it 6 days out of the week, and they get a little piece of a ribbon on their cello.
Wow.
And that motivated them to practice. So I'm all about anything that will get them to practice. The next thing I'm trying to tackle is the quality of their practice and how I can get that better. But I think that my main thing is just curiosity, learning about the kids and kind of what gets them motivated.
Yeah, and I guess participating in most sports can be really similar to learning an instrument and participating in a group activity and using the same types of motivation. I can see how they play really well together. That's a great idea.
Yeah, cello is a little bit more lonely though, right? Like every day they, you know, they have orchestra and school, but their main way of improving is really on their own, doing their own careful practice. So that is my one thing I'm continually trying to. Have you figured that out?
Well, I mean, I would say that most of the students that I work with, they come to me when they're more at that motivated stage. And so I'm not working with, I did when I was younger, but I'm not working with as many students who I have to motivate.
Yeah.
I usually feel like if I have to motivate them, then they probably should find another teacher.
Yes.
So I feel like the motivation that I work with in the studio is when a student is driven and knows they want to get better, to help them take the tools to be better. And that's what they find motivating. But that's a very niche and special kind of teaching. And I can afford to do that because of the way that I teach and the amount that I teach compared to teaching 20 or 30 students a week, which I'm not doing.
Right. Right. Yeah. I try to hack the quality of their practice by using little strategies like record yourself, play with a friend, play for a friend, add a measure, you know, add a note, do these things that kind of make it like games. And sometimes that works, but other times kids have to decide whether or not they want to do cello or not. It's a little tedious sometimes.
Yeah, and we're competing with so many other things that are going on in these students' lives. So they have to really prioritize what's important to them.
Right.
And tell me then how, because I know you're certified as a Suzuki teacher through all of the levels, or where do the levels start and finish?
So there are 10 books you can train in. I've done Suzuki book 1 through 8. I've done it with a bunch of different teachers, and I think it's completely transformed my teaching. I don't know what the heck I was doing before I did the training. And I've also done training with Rainey Sharp in San Francisco, and so, which is such a different approach to teaching, but I feel like very grateful to have both that I can kind of combine into one. So yeah, I teach all ages, basically 4 to 18, and I start with doing really the main thing is in the beginning is setting them up exactly right and micromanaging them kind of really right from the start.
And with the Suzuki training, do you bring the parent into the room and teach in the traditional style where they're part of the lesson and part of the teaching when they're younger?
Sometimes. It depends on the relationship with the parent, but I would say 90% of the time in the beginning, if they are from the age of 4 to 8, the parent is in the room. They're taking notes, unless I find that the parent is infringing on the kid's learning process. I will keep them in there. I try to just tell the parent that I'm going to be the one teaching and that the parent just gets to observe. And the students sometimes feel a little bit intimidated with the parent in there. So I observe how well can the kid learn and feel comfortable. And if they don't, then I just say, hey, parents, you know, you can leave and you can take notes from outside. Uh-huh. But I really do want the kids to be independent and learning on their own. So eventually I would say by like 5th grade, the parents aren't in the room.
Yeah.
But it is really helpful because the amount of little tiny things that the kids have to do during the week is so particular and precise. And I don't feel like a 6-year-old is going to remember to do, you know, make sure your thumb is loose on your left hand and, you know, make sure you do your 10 ski jumps. I feel like the parents really have to guide them, just like they sit down and do their homework with them.
Yeah. Yeah. And so how would you say then that the Suzuki certification that you've received has informed your teaching style the most?
You know, when I first heard about Suzuki, I thought it was kids playing the same song in unison, never learning how to read, not really learning technique, not doing scales. And I was completely wrong. I completely changed my opinion 100%. When I first did my training with Tanya Carey, I observed some of the most beautiful cello playing in her studio, and they could all sight read and they could all play beautifully. But I would say the main thing that I think the Suzuki method develops is the ear. They really, really, really focus on listening a lot, which is why I think sometimes it gets confused with how the students don't learn how to read, but that's not the case at all.
Yeah.
And they really focus on parent involvement. And it's so much of a more of a positive relationship. Like, you sat on your chair the whole time, you sat up tall. Good job on doing that down bow. It's very much less about, oh, you know, you didn't do that up bow there. You didn't sit up tall.
Yeah.
It's more on the positive side of things, which makes kids feel safe and want to learn.
Yeah.
And want to improve and do better. So I would say that's probably the main thing that I've gotten from it.
Do you think that individual technical exercises and things like that, that as students get more advanced, was that also part of the certification? I've never taken any, so that's why I'm asking.
Totally. Totally. I have this book called Cello Playing is Easy from Tanya Carey. And every single book from book 1 to book 8 has a list of techniques that the student needs to learn. So in book 1, I'll just give you an example. Basically, they're doing trill drills as they're in book 2 and 3. They're doing scales. There's a G major, G minor arpeggio they have to do. There's the double stops exercise. So I have all that in addition that I'm teaching them uh-huh. to, like, when they're doing book 1 through 8, there's always additional technical things. And all of those things are built into each lesson.
Yeah. And then at what point do you find that the students transform from, let's say, using their ear more and then looking specifically at what's at the page and really learning how to read the notes? Or would you say that's a natural progression that takes place?
So if they're listening to the recordings, I'll tell you an interesting story. I had a student who was listening to Rigadoon from book one, I don't know, probably 5 times a day. He was listening and dancing to it. And he was reading as well. He was 7. And he came in and he sat down and he just started playing it by ear. I didn't teach him any of the notes, any of the fingers, any of the fingerings, any of the bowings. So he didn't really do the bowings right. But the thing about listening that I know every musician knows, the concept of sound is really the most important thing.
Yeah.
Is that if you can hear it, your fingers eventually are going to start doing it. And so I would say probably by book 3, there's so much repertoire in book 3 that they have to get through. If they're listening regularly, which I know some of my students aren't, and you can always tell if they're listening regularly, then they will be able to start to implement what is, you know, that accent, or they're doing an accent without even really realizing they're doing it because their ear told them to.
Oh, yeah.
And so then they look at the music and then that's congruent with how they played it. And they're like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I'm a really big proponent of listening to the CDs. I mean, that's how we learn how to speak English. You know, we listen to other people speak and we inflect and we cadence and we go up and we go down, just like when we're listening to recordings.
That's how I learn repertoire every week.
Yeah.
It's the quickest way to get it into your brain and then know what you need to work on and identify where the trouble spots are. So it's extremely helpful to listen.
Yeah.
And you said you teach ages 4 to 18?
Yeah.
So no adults then?
I do not. I do not teach. I'm sorry. I do. I have one student that's an adult. It's the parent of one of my 5-year-olds. But otherwise, I don't. I have a hard time with adults. Do you teach adults?
I have in the past. So tell me, why do you have a hard time with adults?
I will just tell you, when I've played for my husband, he's a trumpet player. He says I'm really annoying to teach. Because he says, I don't listen. I don't pay attention to what he says. I start playing before he's even finished telling me what to do. So I'm just thinking about me. You know, I'm a really curious person and I feel like I could potentially be a good student. I'm thinking if I'm annoying, I'm not saying adults are annoying at all. I don't know. I can't explain why, but I don't feel comfortable doing it.
Well, I think one of the challenges I've had when it comes to teaching adults is that let's say you start as an adult, your body has already been shaped and formed over the decades, let's say, that you've been alive.
Yes.
And so you already have some built-in tensions and things that you come to the instrument with. That's the starting point that I think is challenging. And when you're younger and you're learning an instrument, your body is adapting with you a lot of the time. So it can become more natural. So, and I think what happens is then as an adult, that not only do you fight the daily stressors of your life that put themselves in your body and make it more challenging to have some body control and relax, but the other thing is that your mind works a lot faster because of all your experience. So adults tend to want to get way ahead of where they're ready and don't really enjoy doing the building blocks that get you there, like most students will, if you say, do it this way, and that way. And that's the challenge that I've had.
Yeah. And if their hands are a little bit tight, if the muscles in their hand are tight, their muscles in their arms are tight, they just have to be really, really patient. And I actually think adults have a harder time making mistakes than kids do. Mm-hmm. So I don't mind if it takes a really long time to learn something, just as long as there's an attitude of curiosity and kind of being neutral about the mistakes. Yeah. I mean, that really goes for almost every, I would say every kid comes with their own attitude with mistakes. Because some are, oh, oops, I did that.
Right.
And then, you know, if they make one mistake, if another kid makes a mistake, they kind of lose it. And I really try my best to make the atmosphere in my lessons really chill. And if they make a mistake, we just say, okay, well, let's just try again. But this time, let's be mindful. What are we working on? Because typically, the kids that are, or the adults or the kids that are making a mistake are the ones who are trying to do something before they even really understand what they're supposed to be doing. And I find with adults, they are less patient with themselves than the kids are.
Yeah.
So, but my friend Nan is an amazing teacher. She teaches adults and she's amazing. So I know it can be done. It's, I think it's great when people can do it well.
Well, you also have this very wide range. So for example, I've sort of settled into this, I would say 7th to 12th grade is the sweet spot where I end up teaching most students that have a couple years of experience usually under their belt to help. And then I really enjoy the process of getting people ready for college. That period of time is really fun and really have that goal to drive towards, which really starts happening 2 years before you have to really start thinking about what you're going to do. But that's a wide range. So can you identify what's different about when you start with a four-year-old and then how different it is when you're teaching students that are at the end of high school?
So some four-year-olds really, I struggle with this a little bit, just to be completely honest. Sometimes the lesson is just getting them to sit and focus and maybe play their aunt's song. Maybe that's the whole lesson. The progress is not what you would expect out of someone in high school. I remember, I think it was Gilda Barston telling a story. She was in Chicago saying that I think there was one kid she taught for 3 years, and for about two of those years, he was just playing Twinkle, and I think he was like 4 or 5 years old. And the patience that you have to have. But what that kid is learning is focus and discipline, and this is something we do every week. And if they're having fun, that's really what it comes down to, is just you just keep doing it over and over, and eventually it will click. But with a high schooler, that is different, obviously, because they have a humongous amount of stress in their life, just with all of the schools and the college applications and competitions and Allstate and youth orchestra auditions. And so I find, I don't think I have one high school student that's not stressed out. So that's kind of what I'm dealing with. I don't know if you noticed this, but during COVID, in the very beginning, when we were doing Zoom lessons, they were a lot more chill. I don't know if you noticed that, because they weren't with their peers comparing their test results, and they weren't having to get up in the morning really early to get on the bus. But I know obviously they got more stressed out as COVID lingered on, but that's the part that I find the most challenging, is their daily stress in their lives, trying to navigate that and also find time to practice. I don't know how they do it.
Yeah, I think it's really hard. I think about myself and think that if I had had a computer in my pocket all day long, I never would have sat down and practiced the cello. I would have constantly been distracted, and I would not have ended up doing this for a living. I'm certain of that.
I'm really glad I did not have a phone in high school. I didn't even have one in college, actually. I had a beeper.
Me too. I know. I'm really glad too when I think back to that. So I think that students today are dealing with a lot more coming from their environment at them all the time, all these competing factors. I also find, and this has not changed in all the years that I've been teaching, that students in their junior year of high school are absolutely at the peak of stress.
100%.
Because they're taking the SAT a number of times usually, then ACT, more standardized tests. They're concerned about their grades because they're thinking about college in a year. Then add, if they play sports on top of that, or they have other after-school activities, and then add the cello to that. It's just, it's always this point of complete stress when they get to the junior year.
I want to ask the kids who do have time to practice and who actually do, how do they do it? Because I don't really know. I mean, I know it's possible. I know it can be done, obviously, but they must be unbelievably talented and really good at managing their schedule. And also very smart. And they're probably the type of kid you tell them to do something once and they remember it.
I also think the other thing that helps is a lot of students that we end up seeing they're really good students in school to begin with, mm-hmm. and school maybe comes very naturally to them, so they don't have to put in as much time as some other people, yes. or maybe as I felt like I did when yes. I was doing academics. And then if you add that to it, this is the beauty, I think, of learning an instrument, is that if life is coming to you that easily in school and in subjects, have somebody learn an instrument, because for most people, it's not easy at all. And that might be the first time that they run into a real challenge that prepares them for what's going to happen down the road if I'm in college and I have a subject that's really hard
yeah.
when school has come easily to me. How am I going to work around this problem?
They right.
have to learn how. And that's the beauty of learning an instrument over many, many years, is it teaches you short-term planning, long-term planning, and everything in between.
The amount of patience and discipline and repeating things and tedium involved in an instrument. I mean, it's such a gift to have that under your belt to learn. Despite if you're the type of student who needs to be told, I don't know if you've had experience with this, but I used to be like this, where a teacher would say, okay, let's do this with your bowing here. And, then I'd do the bowing. And then she'd say, okay, and now let's add this crescendo. And so I wouldn't do the bowing, but I'd do the crescendo. And so it's like, you always take two steps forward, one step back. Mm-hmm. It's very common, I think. And so you get to learn how to embrace your mistakes. Playing the instrument is like, you're going to learn something, you're going to forget something, you're going to add more, and then you're going to forget one thing. And it's just, but there are students that you can tell them one thing one time and they remember, and then you add on top of it and they remember, and you keep adding and they don't have a problem. Those are the ones that are... I really hate them. No,
yeah.
I'm jealous. I'm jealous of them. They have an amazing working memory.
Yeah. Well, I love your idea of giving the students a measuring stick each week by getting a ribbon, or what were you saying? It was a ribbon, right?
Yeah, it's a ribbon. Yeah.
Okay. So do you have a method of getting feedback from your students as to what they might need more or less of? Do you find a way that they can express to you at some point what they might be looking for in a lesson?
So I should do more of that. But what I usually do is I say, I'll ask the parents if they're in the lesson too. I'll say, how did the homework feel last week? I typically give 5 assignments, technique, repertoire, etude, and listen to a recording. And sometimes I go overboard because they just absorb and they're a little sponge. And so I'll give them like 6 or 7 assignments if I feel like they can do it. And the next week I'll say, how did that feel? Too much? Just, mm-hmm. Too little? They will tell me. And if I'm giving them a new technique, I'll say, is this too easy? Is this too hard? And they'll tell me, and I'll say, enough? Have you had enough or more? When they've had enough, I believe them.
Yeah.
If I'm working on a technique and I'm trying to gauge whether or not they're getting frustrated, I'll say enough. And they'll say, no, I want more. And I'm like, okay, great. Cause I was going to stop because I didn't feel like you were enjoying this.
Yeah.
And I will also say that when they are further along in book 6 or something, if it's like the Vivaldi concerto in D and they absolutely hate it, yeah, I'm not going to make them learn it. Mm-hmm. I don't think a kid should learn a piece they hate.
Yeah.
Cause they're not going to do it. I mean, you can't do that with everything, but if I can find something similar to it, then I will.
Yeah.
So as far as feedback on my teaching, I have never done that actually, and I should. Have you ever done that?
No.
Okay.
That's why I asked you.
Yeah. I mean, every company does it. I called Emory the other day and they said, please stay on the line for a survey on your customer service. And everyone does it. Every successful company gets feedback. So I should probably do it.
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting exercise in thinking about it because, I mean, we get weekly feedback in a lesson, but there must be a better way to find out over several months, maybe each quarter or something, to find out what a student feels like they might be improving on or not improving on, or what things they're happy with or not happy with. Giving them the chance to evaluate you too, I think, could be a really helpful tool.
Yeah.
And makes us better teachers in the end too.
The only thing I was going to add was after they play a piece of music, I'll say, rank 1 to 10. How did you feel? They usually say like 2 or something. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, what do you think you need to do to bring it to a 9? And then they'll tell me. And that will tell me whether or not I've been effective in teaching them what they need to learn for the piece.
Yeah.
But other than that, I haven't done the feedback thing.
Yeah. And there's nothing better than when a student repeats back to you the same things you've been saying to them.
Right. It's really amazing when I'll be like, okay, we're going to focus on that, pull that first finger back and let's make sure that bow is in the string. And then they'll do the exercise, you know, and they don't do it. I said, what were we working on? And they said, the bow hand and the left arm. And I'm like, no, we didn't talk about that. So that just tells me that I didn't say it in a memorable enough way to them.
Yeah.
They were, you know, they blacked out when I was talking to them. I don't know.
Yeah. And what are some of your favorite method books you like to use? I know we have a wide range of ages.
I like using Position Pieces for Cello by Rick Mooney, the Schroeder 170 Foundation Studies, mm-hmm. Full Yard Daily Studies, the Suzuki books, and I use Tanya Carey's Cello Playing is Easy for all the techniques I need all the kids to learn from book 1 to 10.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's great.
So she's got a whole list of things, every technique that is needed for each book.
That's great. So can you think of anything else we might have missed or something you'd like to share with our audience?
So I know a lot of people say, you know, can you see yourself doing anything else besides music? And if so, you should do that. I mean, I see myself doing 100 different jobs. I could see myself doing a lot of things. So I think if you have an entrepreneurial spirit, you can really figure out how to make your way as a musician. But it's not probably going to be in a professional orchestra unless you are really, really going for that, and even still. But it could be you could run a chamber music program. You could run a wedding music business. You could be a private teacher. And I know there are students who've heard, oh, you know, you're from, you know, teachers, oh, you might want to think of another career because you're not going to make it. But it could be so many things. So I think that there are tons of opportunities for musicians in Atlanta, especially. I think there is so much work for musicians. I think if you know how to market yourself and sell yourself and really try to learn to do your craft the best way you can.
That's great advice. So maybe you can share then, where did you see yourself when you were playing in high school and then went to college? What sort of trajectory did you have in mind for your own music business?
So I tried to quit cello when I was in 9th grade, but I didn't make the chorus. So I kept playing begrudgingly. I didn't really want to. And I had lessons as a junior in high school, but I didn't have lessons until then. So I started playing in 6th grade. And after I graduated, I got a business degree. And then I was just very curious. I kind of think there was a voice in the back of my head, don't go into music. I mean, I didn't want to play in an orchestra, but also you would never make it. That's just what I always heard. You would never make it. But I just loved the instrument. And so I had a lesson with Martha Krzyzewski, and she basically said to me, we have to undo 10 years of technique that you've learned, you know, on your own, basically. And so I had such a respect for all the things that she fixed in my cello playing. And I think that's why I really got into teaching, because she kind of started me down the path of like, oh, wow, it is possible to unlearn techniques that you've learned for years and then turn that into, you know, some nice cello playing. So that's kind of how I got started on the teaching track, because I thought, you know, what she did for me, I'd like to do that for others.
Wow. That's really inspiring, actually, because we all have different paths, but to think about having to undo 10 years of habits,
yeah,
and then how that informs your teaching and makes you really a better teacher because of your own journey.
I think that's why I am so obsessed with the teeny tiny little details in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
It can be very annoying for my students. I mean, I'm still probably missing something when I'm teaching, but my thumb was backwards. I lifted my fingers when I shifted. My cello was basically at my belly button. I mean, there were so many things that were so bad in my playing that I was a train wreck. And I just feel like if I can get them started, because if you get a kid started from the get-go with the right technique and form, they can move far pretty fast.
Yeah.
That's why I kind of feel like the most experienced teachers should be teaching beginners.
Uh-huh.
And I know that's not a popular thought, but there's a whole lot of things that can go wrong if they're not set up correctly.
Yeah. I definitely went in reverse. I started on beginners.
Yeah.
For probably 10 years. And I felt like that's what really taught me how to become a better teacher.
Yeah.
If you can break it down at the beginning that way, then when you get students later, you still have something to go back to in the roots, thinking about how it started. Because right. that's really the best way for all of us to learn, I think, is working with students who are just starting out.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the amount of variables, their leg length, their torso, their chair height, are they tryhards or are they jellyfish? Are they squeezing their thumb? They're almost always squeezing their thumb. So there's so many little tiny things to catch. But for me, it's a really fun challenge. I get so much joy out of starting a kid,
yeah.
starting them on the twinkles, and then now they're through book 10. That's the best.
Yeah. So then how many different chairs do you have in your studio?
I have three. I have three in there right now. But they sometimes bring their own. And they have a foot chart if they need helpful. It. So they know where their feet go and they know where the end pin goes. And some of the kids do. Not all of them, but if they need it.
That's great. So where can people find you online?
CelloLessonsWithMaryBeth.com. On Instagram, it's just CelloLessonsWithMaryBeth.
Okay.
And on YouTube, it's @LessonsWithMB.
Great. Well, I will put that in the show notes. And thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much to Mary Beth Bryant for sharing her teaching insights with us, and thank you for listening to our 50th episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. For more information on Mary Beth and any of the links we spoke about today, check out our show notes by scrolling down on the episode. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview Anthony Arnone, Associate Professor of Cello at the University of Iowa School of Music. We talk about his book, The Art of Listening, where he interviewed 13 of the top cello teachers of our time, sharing valuable insights about performing, teaching, music, and life. We're here to serve you. So if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us @thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was produced, edited, and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.